Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management. Mellon.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
It's like watching a bad movie where you already know what's going to happen. Congress passed a war funding bill today, but the president's going to send it right back up Pennsylvania Avenue in a couple of days with the second veto of his presidency on it. And then, maybe, we're going to get to see what really happens. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the important new book, Speaking of Faith, by public radio host Krista Tippett, in bookstores everywhere now. Sustainability coverage supported by Calvert, mutual funds, college savings, and retirement investments in companies committed to responsible environmental, social, and governance practices. Calvert.com.
From the studios of Minnesota Public Radio in St. Paul, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's a Thursday today, the 26th of April. Great to have you with us. $124 billion is the amount we're talking about. Most of it's for military operations in Iraq and Afghanistan. Everybody knows Congress and the White House are going to have to work something out. But Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports it's not just the Pentagon that's interested in making sure a deal gets done.
As he wrapped up Senate debate on the emergency spending bill, Democratic Majority Leader Harry Reid said Congress has added money to the White House request for veterans health care.
We provide for our troops, but we believe we have an obligation to address emergencies facing Americans here at home also.
The bill headed for the president's desk has an extra $21 billion for storm repairs in the Gulf of Mexico, drought relief for farmers, Medicaid reimbursement for doctors and hospitals, and funding for children's health insurance. Worthy program, says Steve Ellis at Taxpayers for Common Sense, but not emergencies.
What happens is Congress sees these emergency spending bills as free money, because they don't count against the budget cap that they've established. And so they end up getting larded up with a lot of other extraneous provisions to try to move it through the process.
Congress has trimmed some of the extra spending. Gone is $100 million for the 2008 presidential conventions and $20 million to fight the Mormon cricket infestation. The bill headed for a veto also raises the minimum wage and gives small businesses $5 billion in tax breaks. The political stalemate will delay war funding for at least several weeks. Military leaders have been careful not to issue ultimatums on when money will run out. Congressional appropriators say the Pentagon has enough to keep the war going through June. Both the White House and Democratic congressional leaders promise quick post-veto negotiations to find a compromise. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Some bad news with the good at Ford Motor Company today. The car maker reported a better-than-expected first-quarter loss of about $282 million. That's a big step up from its $1.4 billion bust a year ago. But Micheline Maynard at the New York Times says there's less to that than meets the eye.
Well, it's always good when Ford can reduce its losses, but its big problem remains North America. And in fact, during the first quarter, its North American loss actually grew.
Ford's in the middle of a massive restructuring, but it's still losing money with trucks and SUVs, which are more than 60% of its business in the U.S. and Canada.
Big vehicles are not selling because gas prices are close to $3 in parts of the country. So they're in a situation where they don't have the kind of lineup to face these higher gasoline prices.
Micheline Maynard at the New York Times. There is an upside for Ford. Sales overseas were healthy, but that's just a small slice of the pie. Oil closed today at about $65 a barrel, or maybe it was $67.60 a barrel. It sort of depends on which benchmark you prefer. We've mentioned supply chain backups have been keeping West Texas Intermediate, that's the New York standard, a couple of bucks below something called Brent crude, which is what the rest of the world uses to set its prices. The big oil story today, though, is Venezuelan heavy crude. Foreign energy firms have until Tuesday to sell their oil interests to the government of President Hugo Chavez. Four firms threw in the towel this week, but Houston-based ConocoPhillips is holding out, which has in turn prompted a warning that Conoco's fields might just be taken outright. From the America's Desk at WLRN Marketplace's Dan Gretsch has more.
It was like a party where one of the guests of honor didn't show. While U.S. firms ExxonMobil and Chevron dutifully signed over control to the Venezuelan government, ConocoPhillips skipped out on the signing ceremony. Analyst Fadel Gate is with Oppenheimer & Company. He says Conoco has major stakes in two of the four oil projects being nationalized.
They are the largest interest in Venezuela, but the smallest of the three. Therefore, pound for pound, they have more at stake than Chevron or Exxon.
With more to lose, Conoco may be negotiating more carefully. Still, Conoco CEO James Mulva said in a conference call that the firm would ultimately turn over its keys to PDVSA, Venezuela's state firm.
PDVSA becomes the operator on 1st of May, and we're working with them to make sure that's done in a very safe and efficient way. There's, that transition's going well, and we don't see any issues or problems in accomplishing that.
The problems may come after the May 1st transition of control. Oil companies still need to be reimbursed for the takeover. Venezuela says it'll pay book value for the projects, which is $10 billion less than the current market value. Edward Glab is a former Exxon executive. He says Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez risks completely alienating the energy firms, whose help he needs to get oil out of the ground.
When you've dug yourself into a deep hole, the first thing you should do is stop digging. Yet it seems every action Chavez takes, he just digs himself a little deeper.
Oil companies have until June 26 to negotiate the terms of the takeover. I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace.
Looks like U.S. airlines are getting out of bankruptcy protection just in time for the summer travel season. Delta's plan to leave Chapter 11 was approved yesterday. Today, flight attendants at Northwest Airlines tentatively agreed to pay cuts that should clear the way for that troubled airline to emerge from bankruptcy by June. Marketplace's Elisa Roth has more now from New York.
Under the latest agreement, Northwest flight attendants would take a big pay cut, saving the company $195 million a year. In exchange, the flight attendants could make a claim as creditors in the company's bankruptcy deal and get a $182 million share of the new company. Will Wilcox works with the flight attendants union in Minneapolis. He has misgivings.
It's never a good day when 8,000 Americans are looking at a concessionary agreement.
He says the new agreement is better than earlier ones in some ways. The equity deal would work out somewhere between $15,000 and $18,000 per member.
Of course, this $182 million equity claim really represents only a portion of what we're giving up in concessions.
Northwest pilots and ground workers already accepted pay cuts in exchange for equity in the new company. Last year, flight attendants voted down two tentative agreements. This time, they need to act fast, though. Creditors, which will now include the flight attendants, only have until May 7th to make claims in the company's bankruptcy reorganization. Airline consultant Mark Kiefer says offering the union's equity in the new company is a clever strategy.
To the extent that the company succeeds and prospers after it emerges from bankruptcy, the employees will share in that.
The agreement still has to be okayed by the union's rank and file. If the latest agreement doesn't pass, the union could try to get approval to strike, but their earlier requests to walk have been denied. Northwest plans to emerge from bankruptcy in June. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
A correction from some early broadcasts yesterday. We did a story on political contributions, and we said Democrat Bill Richardson's the governor of Arizona. He's not. It's New Mexico. Investors might have known what was what today. They just didn't really show it. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Twenty-one years ago today, in the middle of the night, actually, reactor number 4 at the Chernobyl nuclear plant exploded. Even two decades later, there are still substantial fears about nuclear power. But in many corners of the world, they're giving way to even bigger worries about global warming and future energy shortages. Hundreds of new nuclear plants have been proposed worldwide, including 24 here in the U.S. But Sarah Gardner reports from the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, there is one little problem.
For a college student, there's nothing like walking into a career fair knowing the employers are desperate for young talent.
We're at a great location, expanding industry.
If you like traveling, we can offer that traveling option.
We are the largest nuclear utility in the United States.
Those are the voices of eager recruiters in the U.S. nuclear industry. They're at the University of Oregon chatting up the fresh-faced engineering majors here for a national conference.
And your major is nuclear?
Nuclear mechanical dual major.
So tell me a little bit again about
Westinghouse, Areva, Exelon, the National Labs, even the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. They're all here competing for a meager supply of young engineers.
We're at kind of a perfect storm from a staffing standpoint.
Paul Bernison is a recruiter for Areva, a global company that designs and builds nuclear reactors.
We're at a time in the industry where you have the baby boomers retiring, so you've got those people leaving at the back end at a time when the industry is facing a resurgence.
In just 3 years, 27% of the nuclear workforce in the U.S. will be eligible for retirement. It's not clear if the U.S. can replace them, let alone staff new plants on the drawing boards. That's because we sort of skipped a generation when it comes to nuclear power.
In 1980, you had about 65 university nuclear engineering programs operating. Today, it's only about 29.
Carol Berrigan at the Nuclear Energy Institute says Three Mile Island and Chernobyl fueled the anti-nuclear sentiments that stalled industry growth. But now, with rising energy prices and concern over fossil fuels, nuclear is trying to stage a comeback. Trouble is, the pipeline has been empty for a while. Peter Lyons is a commissioner at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission.
The number of students has started to recover in this country, but it is not back to the levels of, say, the 80s.
Right now, the nuclear industry is furiously trying to fill the worker gap, and it's willing to pay.
I'm expecting $50,000, $60,000 a year.
Creighton Adsett is a junior at Rensselaer Polytechnic, and he's expecting that kind of cash right out of college. Other students, like Tony Elliott, with offers in hand, know he's right.
Surprise to my dad, as I would be making more money when I started out than what he's making now.
Oh, yeah, there's a big competition going on, as you can see.
Cenk Guler is here recruiting for Westinghouse. His company is offering signing bonuses, moving allowances.
Now, actually, students are selecting the companies. We are not selecting students. They have to like us.
And it can be hard to keep students like Caleb Robison happy.
I'm really big into reactor design, theoretical design, but I don't like to do the modeling.
You want to be a researcher.
Right, but a hands-on researcher. I don't want to sit behind a desk.
Robison is a junior at Idaho State.
I would like to get into a program somewhere where I can make a difference in the world with hands-on experience and making things better.
20 years ago, not many college students would have connected nuclear power to a better world. In Corvallis, Oregon, I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
Coming up, what globalization means in Bulgaria.
A few years ago, when the poor girl from the countryside arrived in the capital, she quickly learned you can't make a living in traditional music.
But first, let's do the numbers. Stocks edged higher today as strong earnings reports kept rolling in, though a slide in the transport sector kept the lid on broader gains. The Dow Industrials rose 15 points, 0.1%, to close at 13,105. Yes, in case you're curious, that was another record. The NASDAQ crept up 6 points, 0.25%, ending at 2554. The S&P 500 shaved off a single point to close fractionally lower, 1494, the number there. 3M was the comeback kid of the market. Last year, it was the Dow's worst performer. But today, its stock rose 4.5% after it reported first-quarter earnings soared by 52%. Bonds declined. That means the yield on the benchmark 10-year T-note edged up to 4.70%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by SHRM, whose annual conference starts June 24th in Las Vegas, focusing on helping HR professionals align people strategies with business goals. SHRM.org. Science and technology reports are supported by Boston Scientific, committed to delivering what's next in medical technology to help clinicians improve and extend lives. BostonScientific.com. Want to hear something on Marketplace again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and additional special features, just go to the Internet and log on to our website. The information you need when you need it is only a few clicks away. Just head over to marketplace.org.
Here's a look at the Marketplace Datebook for events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Commerce Department releases the first quarter gross domestic product report. The late Kurt Vonnegut is honored in Indianapolis, his hometown. The author was slated to speak at an event on the Butler University campus tomorrow. His son, Mark Vonnegut, will present the program his father had planned. And trees are planted in communities across the country for National Arbor Day. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Student loan companies and college aid officials have a couple of weeks' respite before they have to face Congress again. Senator Ted Kennedy held a hearing into shady dealings in the loan business yesterday. The House Education Committee takes its look into the $85 billion college aid industry May the 10th, which will be just a little bit late for students starting classes next fall because the deadline for sending a deposit to secure enrollment is May the 1st. Commentator Kim Clark's been looking over some of the letters colleges send out with their packages, and she suggests students and their parents read between the lines.
Typically, the college award letters that students get are on fancy letterhead. They're full of congratulations, and they often include impressive-sounding scholarships like leadership awards or presidential grants. But they're also full of jargon. Students thrilled by the big numbers on their awards might not realize that the money isn't always free. The letter might say the money is coming in the form of, say, a CEOG or a subsidized Phelps Stafford or a PLUS. It makes a huge difference. A CEOG is an outright grant, but a subsidized Phelps Stafford isn't. That's a pretty cheap student loan. A PLUS is a pretty expensive parent loan. Another problem is that many schools don't spell out how much the total cost is really going to be. Federal law requires schools to provide total cost information, but many only reveal it if a student asks. One of the financial aid directors recently suspended for allegedly accepting lender money told me a couple of weeks ago why she didn't put cost information on her award letters. "We want them to look at all the aid they've gotten," she said. Of course she does. If parents saw that even after a prestigious-sounding $10,000 scholarship to a private school, they'd still have to cough up almost $40,000 a year, well, many would run the other way. Students often end up burrowing through catalogs or web pages to try to find prices for tuition, fees, room and board. But many schools conveniently forget to tell their students to budget another $3,500 or so for textbooks, travel, and miscellaneous expenses. University officials like to say a college education is so special that it shouldn't be treated like shopping for a car. They're right. It's more expensive and more important. So at the very least, students and parents should be told the sticker price.
Kim Clark is a Kiplinger Fellow at The Ohio State University this semester. She's on leave as a senior writer at U.S. News & World Report. You can take a look at some of those financial aid letters on our website. It's marketplace.org. The United States is sometimes accused of cultural imperialism, American movies or music that become popular overseas, often squeezing out the local talent. And sure, the hot new pop icon sometimes comes from here. But with open airwaves and internet pipelines, the next new thing could come from anywhere. Our series, Working, takes us into the lives of individual people in a constantly changing global economy. Today, almost 20 years into its venture into free market capitalism, we go to Bulgaria and its booming pop music scene. Sandy Tolins in Sofia with this story of a young woman somewhat reluctantly capitalizing on music's economic opportunity.
If Diana Ivanova Dimova could live her dream, she'd be singing this all day long.
the brilliant old stuff sung as stories, as news by her great-great-great-grandmoms to their neighbors across harvests of roses and grapes. But a few years ago, when the poor girl from the countryside arrived in the capital, she quickly learned you can't make a living in traditional music. Diana stands before a microphone in a glassed-in booth, listening to her producer bark out orders. Her traditional training means little here. The pretty, bright-eyed 24-year-old has been tapped to be a new pop diva. She's marketed simply as Diana. Stoyan Denchev, chain-smoking producer of the small record label called Sunny Music, listens to his talent belted out on the other side of the glass. Stoyan tells Diana that even for background vocals, that doesn't cut it. But Stoyan is not too hard on his precious talent. The producer Pygmalion and the Sunny Music marketers are trying to remake her into the newest star of Chalga in Bulgaria, the most popular music here and across the Balkans. Stoyan produced Diana's first CD and now, like his many counterparts around the world pushing low-budget pulsating music, Sunny Music is marketing Diana like crazy. They're booking her in clubs and resorts. They've got her pitching spaghetti in magazines and brochures, and they've got a plan for radio and TV pitches. A sign they're making progress? Bulgarian gossip magazines are starting to dig into Diana's private life. One claimed it caught her lying topless on the beach. For the traditional singer gone pop, it's all a bit of a blur, but there's not much time for reflection. Diana rides the arthritic elevator to the 11th floor of her old Soviet bloc concrete apartment building. Here, it's a meal of pork and potatoes before she gets ready for another night at the club. Standing at the sink, washing the spuds, Diana's not singing Chalga. It's just hours before her club gig, but she prefers to hum the songs her grandmother taught her.
There is a feeling in this music that I can't express in words. The feeling makes me just close my eyes, start dreaming, and immerse myself in the music.
In the lobby of the Chalga Club called Dai Dai, Bulgarian for come on, come on, Diana's airbrushed face peers out through fake blue eyes from the poster of her debut CD. Diana could be any pop star from any country in the world. Diana says when she looks at the poster, she tells herself, next time, I'm not going to let them do that. My brown eyes are fine. She prefers jeans to skirts with slits up to her hip and her own body to the breast implants many Chalga singers have given in to. Inside the club, Diana, in a knee-length white skirt and boots, rocks back and forth on a faux marble dais. Banks of blue lights blink feverishly. Increasingly, across the Balkans, if you want to make your living as a singer, this is the work you do.
It's the same thing over and over again. I get used to it already.
A little proof that she's not a star yet? On this gig, Diana is guaranteed only $10 for the night, plus tips. But she worries about the pull of money. For some better-paid Chalga stars, the performance is barely disguised soft porn. Some singers wear nothing on their breasts but pasted-on stars. A few hours away, at this club in a mountain town, young men encircle a big-time Chalga star, following her like a slow-moving oil slick around the club floor. She gyrates back and forth as the men in the front reach out to brush their fingertips along her bare midriff. Diana stands inside a small recital room at Sophia University, her musical refuge. Here, the young singer and two classmates take instruction from their mentor, one of the masters of the traditional music. Diana's teacher, Svetla Karajova.
It is the powerful voices that give Bulgarian folk music its mystery. They call this new Chalga music pop folk? But that's not right. I don't know who invented that term. Yes, it's captivating to watch on the TV screen, but the songs aren't folk songs, they're just dance songs.
The teacher rails on about the lowbrow Chalga music, oblivious as Diana, sitting over on the couch, furtively pulls out her new Chalga CD and excitedly shows it to her classmates. Their teacher keeps up the tirade against the Chalga sleaze until finally Diana looks up, grim-faced.
Look, I will do whatever it takes to preserve the old music. We won't let it die. I can't imagine anyone letting themselves go without money. How can I do that? I wouldn't survive.
Now she stands up and shows her teacher her new CD. The teacher allows herself a smile. She plants a silent kiss on her pupil's cheek. Diana blushes, and with that, she slips the CD into a computer. Everyone grows quiet. There, four classically trained musicians stand frozen, listening to Diana belt out a new Chalga tune through the tinny speakers of a laptop. In Sofia, Bulgaria, I'm Sandy Tolan for Marketplace.
Our story was produced with Legion Navarro and Veseline Dimitrov. For more on the series Working, and pictures and links to Chalga and traditional Bulgarian music as well, visit marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of a well-diversified college savings plan. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note before we go today, we all know it's not a good idea to lie on your resume, right? Well, the dean of admissions at MIT resigned today after admitting that she had misrepresented her credentials. Mary Lee Jones had been an advocate of easing up on the pressure high school students feel to pad their resumes when applying for college. She had even convinced MIT to change its application to focus less on students' accomplishments and more on their personalities. Her offense, by the way, lying about her college degrees. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow up 15 points, a tenth of 1%, another record close on the corner of Wall and Broad, 13,105. The NASDAQ picked up 6 points, a quarter percent. The S&P 500 fell a point, ending basically flat. Our editors include John Buckley, Margaret Koval, Karen Lowe, Stacey Vanek-Smith, and Lisa Tucker. Special thanks to the staff here in St. Paul this week. Next time on the program back in L.A., can pampering your employees with free massages and game rooms backfire?
Is it a bribe?
No, absolutely not. I would never even consider it as such.
What would happen if they took it away?
I think if they just took it all away, probably go look for a different job.
What could possibly go wrong? I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.